Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The enduring popularity of Arthur Conan Doyle's creation Sherlock Holmes is still alive and well. In fact, I'd have to say the regular reincarnation, reinterpretation, and reinvention of this Victorian-era sleuth ranks up there with some of Shakespeare's greatest characters, maybe save Hamlet. In recent years, there's been a film series with Robert Downey Jr., just concluded a fourth television series with Benedict Cumberbatch, and yet another film a couple of years ago, Mr. Holmes, that reimagines this character at the end of the game, so to speak. So what inspired this Edinburgh doctor to create this amazing character that still speaks to us today, both in his original prose and in contemporary adaptations? Michael Sims is a noted Sherlockian and the author of books on The Story of Charlotte's Web about E.B. White, Adam's Navel, and The Adventures of Henry Thoreau. His latest book writes on the origins of the character Sherlock Holmes and how Doyle's medical teacher, Dr. Joseph Bell, was the model for Holmes' prodigious ability to deduce. He tells the story of the beginning of Arthur Conan Doyle's career in the book Arthur and Sherlock, Conan Doyle and the Creation of Holmes. It's published by Bloomsbury. Michael Sims joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Michael Sims, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This new book, Arthur and Sherlock, sort of follows on a theme you've been exploring in some of your books most recently, which is the origins of a particular novel or really how a writer starts out. And you look at this with Arthur Conan Doyle. Sounds like you're a Sherlock fan already. So what attracted you to this particular story and telling this particular story?
Well, that's a very good point because I had done the book on E.B. White and one on Henry David Thoreau, and in each I had a different goal and approach. And so I knew that as I got the idea for Arthur and Sherlock and thought, wow, do I actually maybe have an original approach for this quite popular topic? I began to hear its own voice and wrote it differently. And smaller paragraphs, very vivid, fast-moving. I wanted to work in as much action as I could and as much dialogue that I could find that was unquestionably accurate. And I realized that part of what I'm doing with each book is a kind of tribute to that author, even though it's, you know, warts and all kind of writing. I don't do hero worship, but I really realized that I had been reading Sherlock Holmes since at least the age of 12, and I wanted to go back and turn it into a story, because some of the accounts by various biographers and others are a little dry, a little short on the drama that Arthur Conan Doyle's life was actually rich in.
Give us a sense of some of that drama that attracted you to it. Now, as I understand it, he was sort of a struggling doctor when he began writing. I mean, he'd set up his own practice. He was trained in Edinburgh, and he set up in the whole south of England, just outside of Portsmouth.
Yes, and that's part of the drama right there. There was drama in his childhood, in a very tragic, dramatic, alcoholic father, and in his growing up poor and fighting in the streets of Edinburgh. But what attracted me first to the idea of writing the book was the beautiful, rich atmosphere and texture of studying medicine in Edinburgh in the 1870s and 80s. It was terrifying. It was gross. It was fascinating. And just to get that texture gave me that thrill that historical and biographical writers talk about, the thrill of resurrecting a real sense of the past. So that aspect of drama played into it.
I would think there are plenty of biographies of Arthur Conan Doyle and the story of how he created Sherlock Holmes. What is particularly unique about yours? I know that it really ends with his first real major tangible success. I mean, you end the book at the point where he's going to be secure and, you know, basically turning out Sherlock stories until he gets tired of them.
Yes. Yeah, at that point, I end when it's pretty much up to him then. The difference, I think, for me is that there are plenty of full-length biographies, of course, of Arthur Conan Doyle, as you said. And I love biographies. I read biographies probably more than any other category. But biographers have to hurry. They have a lot of ground to cover, especially in a busy life such as that of Arthur Conan Doyle. And they can't linger and open up and flesh out a scene. I can. I did. By concentrating on the theme, as you pointed out with my other books, of the inspiration for a character in this book, in Arthur and Sherlock. I can concentrate on those aspects of Arthur Conan Doyle's life that seem to me to have influenced his character in a way that played into the later creation of Sherlock. And then after that study of inspiration, then look at the creation, which is how he applied his experience, which includes his reading and everything else, to writing the book. So I follow through the writing of it. And so I have a lot of scenes that are, a full chapter that might, in a normal biography, get two or three paragraphs, if that.
One person that Doyle owed a great deal of debt to was one of his teachers in Edinburgh, and you spend a lot of time on him. Was this an area of sort of your own original research on the influence of Dr. Joseph Bell?
I did do a considerable bit of original research, and the basic story of Joseph Bell's influence on Doyle is, of course, well known to Sherlockians and always covered by Sherlockian biographers. And I wanted to look more closely at how he fit into the context of his time. I wanted to zoom in and give you a sense of what he sounded like, how he moved, what his own personal story was like behind this that made him the way he was, so that you see how this character came to be in the real world, so that you then later in the book understand why he had such a powerful influence on Doyle. And so in doing that, I looked at Joseph Bell's own writings about his own illness. He contracted diphtheria from trying to save the life of a child and sucking infected mucus from the child's mouth. He was very brave. And for me, part of the fascination with Bell is that he was part of a big movement in the era. Because there was so little technological help, really, for medicine, and so much was riding on being a good diagnostician. There were others that I write about in the book, Ferdinand von Hebra in Austria, for example, who would also do Sherlockian analyses of patients as they came in. And so they developed this. It was theatrical. It was dramatic. It was exciting, but they developed it because they were so short of technology, and they wanted to really apply their own senses to the individual in front of them.
Well, the Joseph Bell you describe in this book is incredibly Sherlockian. I mean, to the point of it's all about the deductions that he would make from a detailed study of the person sitting in front of him. Can you sort of take us through what Arthur Conan Doyle might have experienced watching this doctor at work?
Doyle was quite young. He was in his late teens when he started, and so he had serious hero worship, and he wrote later, and Bell wrote later, about how Doyle would often linger after patients had been there and ask Bell further questions about what he could perceive and deduce about them, and that he would often even then make notes, and this is 10 years before he would be turning those notes into a book or be inspired by those notes. And so he would watch, and the other students would watch as a patient would be shown in, and Bell would, like other diagnosticians of his time, be particularly good at perceiving what they called occupational stigma, the visible result of a job on the skin. So he would perceive different calluses, the needle pricks that would be on the finger and thumb of a tailor, the particular patterns on the clothing. And this was a time when many people wore almost uniform-like predictable clothing, and so often the clothing would bear signs of their profession, like the dents where a cobbler would hold a lapstone for stretching leather. Mm-hmm. And so Doyle perceived Bell doing all of this so many times, it became in his mind a kind of dream of the application of scientific thinking and attention to the world. And later, he was the only writer in his era who wrote about detectives who had had this personal experience of almost superhero-like abilities in the real world.
Hmm. Now, the reason Dr. Bell was doing that was as part of this movement to actually understand the patient so they can understand everything about them to make a proper diagnosis. That was sort of the beginning of that movement, was it not?
Yes, and Bell became one of the most famous practitioners. And then, of course, after the creation of Sherlock Holmes and Doyle's own public thank you notes of various kinds to Bell, Bell became absolutely legendary then. And I wanted to go in, I think, a little under the legend, before the legend, and look at what his daily life was like. I kept thinking, what did he look like going down the hall at Edinburgh Medical School or at the infirmary or wherever? How did he behave when interviewing patients? And so I found lots and lots of beautiful little details by various students who had studied with him.
And so these stories were sort of widely held among his students, this ability to make deductions.
Yes, yes. And others wrote about it later. People had commented on it elsewhere and before Doyle wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories. But then after he acknowledged Bell as his inspiration, many former students then added their own stories and would publish them in tributes to Bell or elsewhere. So I was able to find a lot of those things. And what I found very satisfying as a person writing biographical narratives here is that often the stories would be mutually supporting, not precisely the same word, of course, of remembered dialogue, but very similar descriptions of Bell's techniques and his behavior in the class. And so that was confirmation I really felt I needed.
My guest today is Michael Sims, author of a number of books, and most recently several books that have looked at the beginnings of writers, a story of Charlotte's Web, a story of how Henry David Thoreau got started on his way to Walden. And his latest book is titled Arthur and Sherlock, Conan Doyle and the Creation of Holmes. It's published by Bloomsbury. Well, we earlier sort of alluded to Doyle's early life. Doyle had an interesting family because he had some writing, well, at least publishing success within his larger family. And his father, as you mentioned, was pretty much of an alcoholic, a illustrator, and he had an uncle that was a very famous illustrator, correct?
Yes, the cartoonist who worked under the name H.B. So his uncle, his father's brother, was a successful illustrator and cartoonist, and also their father. So a lot of good family background. And as a small child, Arthur was dandled on the knee of Thackeray, who wrote Vanity Fair. So a lot of things like that. And then growing up in Edinburgh itself, the city was infused with respect for writing and scholarship. And Walter Scott was, you know, the patron saint of the city, practically. There was a huge Scott monument featuring a bunch of his characters turned into bronze cavorting in a square in Edinburgh. So the family background and the city background all played into Doyle catching on fire with a passionate enthusiasm for literature.
But he was a bit of a tough, wasn't he?
Yes. Throughout his life, I think it was sort of like Theodore Roosevelt in that he wanted to be perceived as a manly man. But he really genuinely loved outdoor sports very much, blood sports early on, and then later, one of the first prominent people to be very enthusiastic about skiing, bringing it farther out, you know, than just the Alps. And he and his wife, first wife, took up the fad of competition tricycling. So many fascinating details about that. And he, during medical school, took a break to serve as medical helper on board an Arctic whaling vessel. And so that was fun.
I thought that was interesting. He did. We always think of, you know, Dr. Watson as being, you know, serving in Afghanistan. I figured there might be some, you know, either India or part of the British Raj, if you will. But no, he went north on a whaling vessel.
Yes, and then he also went on another ship along the coast of Africa. So he had spent considerable time adventuring, and he also talked often himself, admitted that he had a very reckless streak that he found almost incomprehensible. He risked his life for absolutely no reason a number of different times. He would swim in shark-infested waters from one of the ships. In the Arctic, he was just the young kid, the medical guy, who they would get a medical student because they were cheap. He wasn't expected to do much except hand out bandages and tobacco. And instead, he went out on the whaling ships. He clubbed baby harp seals, not his most popular moment in his biography.
Right.
And he dived into everything in every direction as much as he could. And later, he was knighted, not for his contributions to literature, but for his contributions to British history and, in a sense, to the promotion of the imperialist agenda of the crown.
Now, one of the interesting things about as he's beginning to write these stories is how many of the names come from real life. I had never known that.
Yes, that was really fun. And now you can't be certain, but if he names a character Gregson in practically the very month that a person named Gregson moves next door to him, and it's an unusual name, you know, some of these are of the kind where the writer would say, it is very likely that, or apparently. But some of them are definite. His family greatly admired the American writer Oliver Wendell Holmes, and the name Holmes was sort of always spoken of respectfully, and Doyle liked his writing very much. And then Holmes was a common name associated with London, from Holmes's Illustrated Guide to London. And so there are a lot of little things like that. He had gone to school with someone who had the surname Sherlock. There were actually, at the time of his writing, there were two fairly well-known Inspector Sherlocks in different parts of the London Police Department. So lots of great little details to look into.
The Inspector Lestrade was, a schoolmate. There was a Lestrade that was a schoolmate in Edinburgh.
Yes, very good point. That's a particularly unusual name, and that you don't find in the London guides at the time or address books or anything. And since he went to school with someone with this name, it seems very likely that it just stayed in his mind. And then there are other things where he first named Watson Ormond Thacker or Secker, and a name that sounds very dandified to us now in opposition to a stolid John Bull sort of Dr. Watson name. But a single walk around the great Ormond Street Hospital, which he was very familiar with, indicates a number of different streets and intersections where there are names that very likely popped right into his writing.
You mentioned Dr. Joseph Bell's being this great influence, but in creating Sherlock Holmes, Doyle mentions actually two influences, Dr. Bell for his deductions, and then Edgar Allan Poe's character, Monsieur Dupin.
Yes, and Dupin was not had not achieved the legendary popularity and could not have for several reasons, but Poe had written three stories about him, most famously The Murders in the Rue Morgue, which is pretty much canonized as the first solid, real detective story. Although in an anthology I did called The Dead Witness, I ran a story that definitely appeared before that, but it has nothing like that kind of charm and excitement. Doyle loved Poe's writing in general. He liked his ghost stories, his adventure and science fiction stories, everything. And he had read him since childhood. And he later said that Holmes was in part Dr. Bell and in part Auguste Dupin. And those combinations are really very telling because he uses aspects of Dupin, but as inspiration. I don't mean he copies them. But then he gives it so much life and wit and texture and enthusiasm that Poe did not in writing his very dark, very logic-minded stories. And so Doyle took the idea and made it much more alive and awake for the rest of us.
Well, you mentioned one of the things he copied was the fact that you have 221B Upper Baker Street. That comes right out of Poe because that was very important to have this residence with an address for some reason.
Yes, I think it's not a terribly significant point, but it's interesting that all of a sudden detectives are getting pinned down very carefully into specific places in the real world. And I think that does anchor them in the same way that later Rick Stout would always have Nero Wolfe on 35th Street in New York. It gives you a sense of what they're coming from. And nowadays, of course, local texture and atmosphere in detective stories is the key to everything.
Right. Getting back to Doyle's story, he grew up in Edinburgh. He went to school in Edinburgh. He has these adventures. And when he sets up to practice medicine, he moves nearly the length of the island. What possessed him to do that? He certainly had to have been struggling, and it sounds like he was struggling at first to gather a practice. Was he always thinking about writing, or was this something after he had established as a doctor that he decided to write?
He had always been writing, starting at a very young age, and writing about short stories about ghosts, adventures of various kinds, and imitating American writers such as Bret Hart, imitating Poe somewhat. So when he moved all the way to Southsea, part of Portsmouth, across the channel from France, you're right. He was moving about as far as it was possible to move within the United Kingdom. And he had always been somewhat impulsive, and he had tried a couple of different positions, including one right out of medical school, with various people he had known or studied with who offered him a position. And he tried one and parted with that from that person, apparently not terribly amicably. And he seems to have impulsively gone off and tried his hand at creating his own practice. At the time, it was common to buy into one. You buy, in a sense, the patients and the equipment of an established practice. Well, he was too young and inexperienced to do that, so he had to find the cheapest possible place, and he found a modest place in Southsea, a part of Portsmouth, and began trying to fight his way up. And the early days of that, I wanted to give some sense of the texture of and how he would peer through the wooden blinds down at the street and count the number of people who stopped to look at his sign.
Eventually, he begins writing. He has some success, and he starts writing, and he's come up on all these details. He's molded his memories of Dr. Bell and the literary influences of Poe and others and creating these characters that we now know. Was it difficult for him to get started, or because of his family's connections in the literary world, was it a little easier?
I think for what he wanted to do at the time, his family connections didn't help at all. They were mostly in the visual arts, and despite some connections, I think he got very little out of that in helping him with momentum. He worked his way up from absolutely nowhere, being no one, and at the time, most short stories were still published anonymously. That was beginning to fade, but had not yet. And so he might read a short story and think, gosh, that's probably by Robert Louis Stevenson, but no one would literally know until the book version was published. So that what he did manage to write and publish began to slowly gain him a reputation with a few editors, but absolutely no reputation with the public because no one knew yet who he was. No one even knew that the story they read in Blackwoods might be by the same guy as the story they read in The Cornhill.
Now, his first big break was The Study in Scarlet, although he sort of learned a bit about publishing in the publication of that story.
Yes, he had a bitter lesson that he paid a lot of attention to for the rest of his life. Beaton's Christmas Annual, which was a marketing and advertising thing that published a novel and a couple of stories or plays every year, bought A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes novel, in early 1886, and said, "We can't publish it until the Christmas 87. We cannot offer royalties, but we're happy to give you £25 outright for full copyright." Of course, he fought and argued, and they didn't give in, and he was feeling the beginner's sense of desperation that we all have, and he said yes. And as he wrote in his autobiography later, he never earned another penny from what soon became a legendary novel.
And from that he learned his lesson.
Yes. And then also he was picked up soon after this, after he published a second novel. And the little details that are so fun, like the second novel, The Sign of the Four, was commissioned by J.B. Lippincott, the American publisher, at a dinner in London at which they also commissioned the young poet Oscar Wilde to write a novel, which became The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Interesting. Well, before we let you go, PBS has just finished the last series of the updated Sherlock. Just the last year or so, there was a film, Mr. Holmes, a reimagining of a much older, almost infirm version of this hero. What do you think the fascination of this character still remains, what's your thoughts of why these characters are so interesting to us?
I think it's interesting that different approaches tackle different aspects of the sort of classic Holmes's personality. Like you can emphasize his obsessiveness or his drug addictions or whatever, but it keeps coming back to that in a sense he is an ideal Marvel Comics type flawed superhero. He's to me, something like one of the X-Men. He has a superpower, but it's mental, an intellectual eagle eye, and he had studied until he was an encyclopedia of what had been done in crime, so in a sense you couldn't surprise him. And also, in many cases, he has a Robin Hood sort of disdain for authority, a lack of interest in just the money, scorning the official police, yet willing to help them. And I think it's very easy to imagine him on our side, and it's not like The Flash or something that you know is fantasy, that from any moment to moment, Holmes is believable. Overall, it all adds up to a kind of fantastic, mythic figure. But I think that he's heroic in a way that is beginning to fade somewhat in a kind of anti-intellectual, anti-science sort of era. He is still an independent, heroic, rational hero.
Now, obviously, you're one of those great Sherlock fans. You've written and edited anthologies of Holmes-inspired work. What do you think about the new updating that we're seeing in films and television, like the Robert Downey Sherlock or Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock? Do these still speak to you as a sort of a dedicated Holmesophile?
It's interesting how they speak to different people. They bring new kinds of readers. To me, they don't move me as much as the original stories. And in a sense, I'm not saying I'm a purist, and there's no manifesto in that. It's just that the updating, the playing with, I understand, in the same way that you see Shakespeare restaged with everyone from Julius Caesar dressed as 1930s anarchists or whatever.
Right.
You know, the powerful things. Or you get Jane Austen, Vampire Hunter. so all of these many ways of playing with these figures, I think, are good and interesting. Like Robert Downey Jr. doing bare-knuckle fistfighting. That is mentioned, that Holmes does that. You know, that you can dive in there and find all of these things. And creating many ways of looking at the same character really is, as you said, a kind of testament to his protean mythic power. I'm happy to see all of these things happening. And yes, and I was invited to write a story for an anthology of pastiches, and I looked at my favorite of the stories, Silver Blaze, and thought, oh, I seem to be playing this game myself now, because I reimagined the whole story told from the point of view of the horse. So, I mean, there's room for an awful lot of play in the mysterious precincts of this kind of magical figure.
The name of the book is Arthur and Sherlock, Conan Doyle and the Creation of Holmes. It's published by Bloomsbury. Michael Sims is the author and my guest. Michael, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
Writer Michael Sims speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the author of Arthur and Sherlock, Conan Doyle and the Creation of Holmes. It's published by Bloomsbury. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.